Hello and welcome to the second Hidden Histories episode on the Freedom Foil podcast. I am one of your hosts, Joe, and I am joined by my beautiful co-host, Mary.
Hey, guys.
Second time we're recording this, so, you know. It is what it is, guys. Sometimes throwing these together, I start rambling, and Mary's trying to keep it on task, and these it just falls apart.
It's just tough when you talk about these topics that have so much to them, and they don't have a natural timeline.
Well, and it's my fault, too, because I'm going, like, I tend to just, like, you know, go off memory and stuff, and that's not fair to Mary, because she's... she's not super into reading books and shit all about this, and you know it's difficult.
Well,
so
that all that being said, you guys should know that we put a lot of effort into making these organized and and easy to follow. So
and to try
just
to
know that.
And to try to bring you information that's unknown. A lot of people don't get this, but our Hidden Histories episodes is not about conspiracies. It's trying to show you a point in history that we think government wants to cover up, and they don't want you to see the true and honest information. And our goal is to objectively present you that information.
Yeah.
Before we get started, as always, there are links in the bio to the Freedom Foil Instagram account. If you check that, you want to see us, shoot us a message, whatever, we really appreciate that. There are links to the information that we go over. And then there, of course, are also links to the Firearm Freedom page, which is all the gun-related content that I run. So if you guys want to check it out, feel free. Our topic this week is one that I think me and Mary both are very passionate about, which is Waco. Which I appreciate it. So this is one that, oh my God, it gets my blood boiling like crazy, and it worked out perfectly because, you know, I'm full disclosure, very passionate about learning everything there is to know about Waco itself and the
similar
siege
to Ruby
that,
Ridge.
Yeah. And the siege that happened there and the Branch Davidians and all of those things. And I actually am just finishing up. I have like a chapter and a half left of Waco, A Survivor's Story, which is a book written by David Thibodeau. It was originally published under the name of A Place Called Waco. And it's the book was phenomenal. And actually, a side note, it's actually probably one of the best books I've ever read.
I know,
it's crazy.
Statement.
I don't think you expected me to say that, but Waco aside, it's very well written. It like immediately pulls you in because it starts with the end of the siege, which we'll get into, immediately brings you in. I mean, and David Thibodeau is one of the Davidian survivors that left the building when it was on fire.
Yeah.
So he stayed the entire duration of the 51-day siege, was there from start to finish. And David Thibodeau comes at it from a very unique angle because he was not a religious person. He was just a drummer in LA that came from Bangor, Maine, and just like was kind of a lost soul a little bit.
Wasn't he just like in a bar and met David Thibodeau?
No, so they actually met, and this is where the mini series kind of isn't accurate. They actually met at a guitar center. So David Thibodeau was trying out drums and like shredding the drums in a guitar center, and none other than David Koresh and Steve Snyder.
His number
Schneider,
two man.
Yeah, were there, and they were at, because they actually had a band.
For the church,
and they were all very good musicians, like, you know, worship music aside, they played other shit as well. And Thibodeau, you know, they started talking, he's like, do you want to play gigs for us? And Thibodeau's like, I'm not trying to get into, like, you know, Bible stuff or whatever. They had one Bible reading with Steve Schneider and David Koresh, and that was it.
And then, just right there, before we even get into all of this, shows you the power, and I would dare say, somewhat manipulation of David Koresh into bringing people into this.
We'll get into it, but the weird shit, the only thing I will say that's interesting, or maybe just the power that someone's interpretations of the Bible and how they can talk and this whatever religion it is, you know, the one thing that's rather bizarre about Koresh is how many regular, like, we're not talking Bible people, we're not talking like,
and from all over the world,
we're talking theologists and people that are incredibly well-versed in biblical studies in every facet, and they would have one conversation with, we're talking law enforcement as well, like people totally outside of it, and just
joined.
Boom, like in. And that's what, that's the only thing that in my research into Waco that I'm like, that's interesting.
Crazy.
Because a lot of the times with other more extreme ends of the religious belief system, whatever that religious belief is, you know, normally you got to be kind
of born
like,
into
yeah,
it,
you're kinda,
or you know people that are already in it that you kind
right.
of have like mind.
With this, it was like one. All of a sudden, they were like, "I don't want to do this," and a 6-hour Bible study later, they're devoting their entire life.
It's crazy.
And they're living there.
So
you know?
Giving them a, just like a very high level definition of Waco. So the Waco siege, also known as the Waco massacre, was the law enforcement siege of the compound that belonged to the religious sector branch of Davidians. It was carried out by the U.S. federal government, Texas state law enforcement, and the U.S. military between February 28th and April 19th in 1993. This is the branch of Davidians, as we mentioned, is led by David Koresh and headquartered at Mount Carmel Center Ranch in Axtell, Texas, which is actually 13 miles northeast of Waco. I believe they mention and call most of the writings and things about Waco because, as we'll go into, one of the original locations of this religion, if you will, was actually in Waco. And then they ended up moving a couple times and found themselves on a pretty substantial plot of land outside.
Well, they
of Waco.
Originated from Seventh-day Adventists, right? So,
yep.
Yeah, and which I don't know much about Seventh-day Adventists, but I believe it kind of surrounds the belief of the second coming of Christ and an apocalyptic, rather dramatic apocalyptic ending. Right.
So do you mind if I give them like a background
yeah,
and then I'll let
do,
you drive?
Yeah.
All right. So a little bit of background here. The religious group originated in 1955 from a schism in the Shepherd's Rod.
Schism.
Yeah. And in parentheses, it's the Davidians. So this was following the death of founder Victor Hutef. So Hutef founded the Davidians based on his prophecy of an imminent apocalypse involved the second coming of Jesus and the defeat of the evil armies of Babylon. Like I mentioned, he moved the church to Waco when they started gaining members and named it Mount Carmel after a mountain in Israel that is mentioned in the Bible. And years later, he moved again to a large location east of Waco. So Hutef's widow, Florence Hutef, announced the expected Armageddon that was about to take place when she kind of took power after his death.
In 1959 or something, right?
Yeah, and she told members that they needed to gather at the center to await the event. Dude, people were building houses. They were in tents, trucks,
businesses. Expecting like the end of the world.
Sold all their possessions, right? Thinking that, well, we're going to die anyway. We'll get rid of all our things. So obviously that didn't happen. So following that failed announcement, the site control actually fell to a man named Benjamin Roden. He was the founder of the specific branch of Davidians, again, the Seventh-day Adventist Association. Roden promoted different doctrinal beliefs than those of Hutef, the original founder. And when he died, the power fell to his wife, Louise Roden, and she felt that her son, George, was just unfit to assume this position. So she kind of maintained that power while grooming a man named Vernon Wayne Howell, later known as David Koresh, to be her successor. So there's already a power struggle between
Lois Roden, not
Louise. Oh, sorry,
Louise.
Lois Roden and,
son.
Well, no, the tension is George Roden and David Koresh
her
at this
son,
point.
Her son, right.
Yeah, because George Roden, the son, is all pissy pants because she's grooming David Koresh, right?
Yeah, and she's
so,
basically like, you're too stupid
yeah,
to do
you,
this.
Yeah, you can't handle this, so I'm going to make sure that somebody can take this over when I die. Yeah. So 1984, a meeting led to the division of the group with Howell leading one faction, branch of Davidians, and George Roden leading the competing faction. So now you have basically two teams. You have the Koresh team and the Roden team, right?
Yeah.
And then after Lois Roden's death, Howell tried to gain back control of Mount Carmel. And I keep calling him Howell. we'll call him Crash.
Fun fact, side note, Lois Roden groomed him and was having quite a bit of sexual relations with David Koresh. And they were trying to, even though she was in her mid to late 60s, I know, bit rough. I pulled up the picture of her and I'm like, maybe, I don't know, maybe she's like a drop dead bombshell or something.
She was not.
Looked like an older lady. They were doing this to try and prove that even though she was at that age, they were trying to like have a child and prove that it was like the child of God because it, you know, she was pregnant at,
it's rather crazy, interesting,
but that's
60 years old and you're having a kid.
Well, she didn't end up getting pregnant, I don't believe. So yeah.
So now we have these two factions, Branch Davidians and then George Roden's little group. And then after the split, Roden actually ran Koresh and his followers off of Mount Carmel at gunpoint. And so Koresh relocated his group to Palestine, Texas. And after Lois Roden's death, Koresh tried to gain back control of Mount Carmel. And this is very interesting, and I won't harp on this too long, but George Roden had dug up the casket of Anna Hughes from the Davidian Cemetery and challenged Koresh to a resurrection contest to prove who was the rightful heir to leadership. Basically, like, throw down.
Surprise, surprise. Roden is actually a little mentally ill.
You don't say.
And that was when, what, Koresh reported him to the police? Because he's like, I'm good, dude. You're a psychopath.
And this is kind of like, I mean, I'm sure the police always had them on their radar, but this is probably the first time where, like, someone from the religion, like, reached out to them for actual help. So Koresh instead went to the police and claimed Roden was guilty of corpse abuse, but the county prosecutors refused to file charges without proof. On November 3rd, my birthday, 1987, Howell and seven armed companions tried to get into Mount Carmel. Koresh and seven armed companions tried to get into
Mount Carmel. It's tough because his original name is Howell, and they say it a lot in this. So
they tried to get into intending on taking a photograph of the body in the casket as incriminating evidence, and Roden just started open firing on these guys.
To be fair, by secretly getting in, they did bring rifles. They were armed, like, so they, you know, they were kind of doing their own police work and doing a little
and
side
on private property that they weren't allowed to be on,
right, on side operations there, where they kind of were like, we're fucking going in.
So the sheriff's department responded to do about 20 minutes into this gunfight, and Roden was already wounded. Sheriff Harwell got Koresh on the phone and told him to stop shooting and surrender. Koresh and his companions, dubbed the Rodenville Eight by the media, were tried for attempted murder on the 12th of April, 1988, and seven of them were acquitted, and the jury hung on Koresh's verdict, and the county prosecutors didn't press it any further, so basically they got away with it. While in trial, Roden admitted to attempting to resurrect Ann Hughes on three occasions.
He also told his guilt by saying that, because he admitted his guilt by saying, hey, yeah, I did mess with the corpse and, you know, was trying to fuck with it and all this stuff.
So he went to jail. Mid 1989, Roden used an axe to kill a Davidian named Wayman Dale Ader, who visited him in jail to discuss Ader's alleged vision of being God's chosen Messiah. And Roden just went to town and killed him.
Yeah.
After Roden was then committed to this mental hospital, all of the followers from the two factions kind of came together to join and create that one, you know, sector or that one group of people now called
Koresh's
the Branch.
Followers slowly started to kind of like move in, and they get the vibe that, like, okay, so we're just all now Koresh is the leader.
Yeah. And wouldn't be till 1990 when Howell officially changed his name to Koresh.
Correct.
So now we're officially David Koresh. And that makes sense. But yeah, there's that little background on, like, you can just see the struggle of power, and that Koresh wasn't the original leader of this.
Now, then we start, after a few years of Mount Carmel being under Koresh's control, and him being the main person there, we get to the very controversial area. And this is actually where a good majority of his followers left. And that was under his New Light vision. That I believe it was when he was, I don't know that they say this here, but I believe it was when he was on a spiritual trip in Israel or something like that. And I think it was at Mount Vernon or something along those lines, mm-hmm. and he got a vision. This is from Koresh. He got a vision from God that told him of the new light prophecy.
Which was what?
If you're here, I need to have sex with your wife, essentially.
Oh, and you have to stay celibate.
And you have to stay celibate. Now, not there. So this is coming from reading it from a Davidian, right? Like reading it from David Thibodeau's book and everything. Koresh laid this out, right or wrong. This is what Koresh said, that essentially there are 24, I think it is, children under this apocalyptic, the seven seals and all of these things in Revelations. There's 24 okay. like elders or something like that. And Koresh said that because he, is who he is, God gave him the mission to create these 24 sacred children.
I'm rolling my eyes.
Right. I'm not saying this is right or wrong. I'm just trying to tell you guys objectively what their belief system was. Then from that, he also said that essentially sexual desires and sex in and of itself to not create these 24 children is
a sin. A sin,
sacrilegious. It's a distraction from your faith. So Koresh says, I'm the only one that will take this burden of this sexual desire and all of these things. And actually, most of the women that were in what ended up being called David's house of women came to him requesting to be this chosen, woman of God to carry one of the 24
elders.
This is
where I drop my objective
right.
viewpoint, and I am stating my opinion at this point.
It's fucked.
That is purely manipulation.
Absolutely.
Especially when you get married couples in, you separate
totally
married
agree.
Couples, and you get the women to beg you.
Right.
No.
I totally agree.
No.
I don't disagree at all.
So what's the other part, though? There's another part to his new light recording or audio tape that he presented. He would, Koresh also said that God had told him to start building an army. So that was kind of the people that you were talking about, the 24 people.
Well, yeah, an army of God, which was the 24 elders.
To prepare
for
the end of days and salvation for his followers.
Right. Now, that could be taken out of context because he doesn't necessarily mean
military.
Yeah, like we're going to build militants to go attack people. It was a defensive rather than offensive. There's a lot of psychiatrists that study, cults
wording.
And other things that said that this is, you have two types of religious, extreme religious sectors, which is either an offensive, which is going to actually use their belief system to attack the outside world, and then you have a defensive. And typically, with apocalyptic religion beliefs, that kind of goes one of two ways. And in this case, the Davidians were very verifiably defensive.
That's such an interesting point.
They thought this was coming to them and that they needed to prepare themselves for the end of days.
Interesting.
So when it comes to the last point I want to make there about the new light, this was actually what ended up being the catalyst for Mark, I can't pronounce his last, Brolat, but I have no idea how to pronounce his last name. I'm sure it's easy if you say it out loud, but I don't know. But one of the main Davidians that was essentially David's Judas in this case, or right-hand man, that when he got his new light prophecy, he's like, fuck you, and he just married this girl, and he leaves. And then
with
also
the woman?
With the woman, because they're like, we love each other. Like, we're not, this is ridiculous, whatever, I'm out. And that's what a lot of people said. Now, in this case, Mark was one of the main people that was contacting the FBI during the siege, telling him about Mount Carmel and all the crazy shit that was going on, and David's a psychopath, and they're beating children, and they're raping everybody, and they have all these weapons and all this shit, when he had a more vindictive narrative because he was pissed at David.
But
so,
objectively,
right.
I will also explain that
right.
we are making it seem like these wives were like of age. They were not.
A lot of them were underage, absolutely.
Like 12 or 13.
Yes,
which
absolutely.
Is disgusting.
Right.
And that is, by definition, statutory rape.
Absolutely. And even David Thibodeau, multiple times in the book, says that David
was
absolutely
wrong.
Was guilty of statutory rape. There's no, it's verifiable. That's accurate. And that's what a lot of people when you look into this and, you know, you are on kind of one of two sides, which is...
Or you're in the middle. Like, I'm very much just very pulled in both ways.
Right. And, you know, you have the people that are very, very, you know, on the FBI and ATF side, like, yeah, fuck those people. They got what they deserved. And then you have people that are on the anti-government side that are like, you know, no. But looking at it objectively... David Koresh did do some pretty fucked up shit and was absolutely guilty of statutory rape. It's not this like sunshine and rainbows area where nothing was going on. That was again, I think people
like
get
they were
that
just
in the
like,
wrong light.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That did happen. That
but
absolutely
again, this
did
is
happen.
This is us bringing objective information to you. We got to present it all. So this part you had mentioned about Mark, the Judas of the group that kind of left and was explaining and kind of an informant, if you will,
right,
to the FBI and the government. So is this what sparks the 1992 ATF opening the formal investigation?
No. What originally sparked it was actually a UPS driver. So essentially, and a lot of people don't know this, and this is a very, very important point legally speaking, when we start bringing in why this happened to these people. The Branch Davidians were doing tasks and jobs to get money to all go to their buildings. That they were rebuilding up Mount Carmel, making like swimming pools, buying go-karts for the kids that were there, churches, all this shit. And they needed money to do that. None of them like worked regular jobs. Some of them did. Like one of them, I think it was Wayne, was another kind of higher up person there that was a lawyer and was actually a lawyer in the town of Waco, or the city of Waco. But they needed money, and they realized that, you know, they're in Texas. It's typically, especially at this time, was huge in the gun industry. So they actually obtained their federal firearms license, any license that a gun shop would get to buy and sell firearms. A regular person, you couldn't just buy 20 guns and then go and sell 20 guns for the purpose of making a profit. Right. The ATF would frown upon that, and it's against the federal law to do that. So they abided by federal law, and they had a federal firearms license.
Also known as an FFL.
Also known as an FFL. A lot of people don't know that. And they were buying firearms mainly from a local gun shop in the area, and they were selling them at gun shows. And then the women of the church would embroider and sew these like camo vests and ammo carriers and other things as clothing to sell. I think it was like Mags and Bags was their gun shop or
I
something
mean,
like
interesting
that.
Interesting choice to
right.
make money.
And they had a physical gun shop location. It was separate from Mount Carmel in the city.
So
they just straight up ran a gun shop.
That's weird though, right?
I mean, it is and it isn't. They saw that as a way to make money, and it was a way to make a shitload of money. I mean, you know, if you want to make a shop, and it doesn't matter if you're into guns or not, you're making some money. So that's what they were doing. Now,
so tell me about this UPS guy.
The UPS driver, they were getting multiple deliveries, and the UPS driver allegedly knocked over a box that had dummy grenades. Now, if you don't know what a dummy grenade is, it's a completely inert grenade. So it looks like one. It kind of has all that feel. People use it as paperweights, but it is completely inoperable. There's a hole drilled in the bottom of it, and everything that makes it go boom is gone. It's just essentially a shell that looks like a grenade. People buy them a ton at gun shows because it's kind of like, oh, it's cool. I could put it on my desk or whatever. I have one, and I use it
so
as a book stop on my desk.
They purchased or had these to sell.
Correct. Yeah, they had them to sell.
As
now,
like a tchotchke kind of thing.
Yes. Now, the UPS driver is like, well, I knocked over this, and I knocked over gunpowder, and I knocked over 30 AR-15 magazines, and I knocked over all of these other components, and then that was reported to the ATF, and the ATF said, well, we think they're remaking these grenades into explosives and selling them, that they're just selling live grenades at gun shows. So that was
how do you feel about that?
I think personally, it's bullshit. And if you read the actual article, this is where it gets frustrating, because if you know anything about guns, you know why it's bullshit. So the ATF claims that they were buying M16 parts kits is what they said. So you don't have to know anything about guns. An M16, an actual M16, is a select fire full auto capable AR-15 variant, essentially, right? So in the article here at the wiki page, it says those components were upper receivers, which if you know anything about firearms, you will know that that is the non-serialized, non-firearm part and has absolutely nothing to do with the machine gun.
I'm going to fight you a little bit. So at this point, right? So you're David Koresh, your members, your whatever. You catch wind that like, oh, we got some heat with the ATF. We're not doing too
they
hot
didn't
on that
know thing. They had heat at this
okay.
point.
So, well, then I guess my argument doesn't
That's what
stand.
I mean. Yeah. Now, they
but
also...
But again, I just think it's odd. If I'm being completely, like, transparent here, I just think it's odd that a branch of, you know, Seventh-day Adventists or Christians or whatever this is based in, you know, they claim to be these peaceful, like, you know, people just, like, trying to live their lives. I get that.
Yeah.
And I get that they need to make money somehow. But you have a group of how many people? Hundreds?
It was over 100.
Okay. Come on.
Yeah.
You have a broad range of skills. We talked about a lawyer in there. We talked about theology. You have skill sets in there that go beyond just selling firearms. I don't understand
but,
why
also, they
had to depend on, you know, you have hundreds of people, but oh, we have to depend on this one gun shop to bring in all of our money.
I will argue that they didn't depend on it. And they actually also, Koresh himself, were into guns. Like they had a firing range on the property.
That's good enough
for
me.
They would shoot on the property like they just liked guns.
I just needed to say that because
right.
I have a feeling that someone was probably wondering.
I want you to because it's coming. You're not, you know, into guns like I'm into guns as far as like, you know, it's not a hobby of yours. So it's an interesting perspective. Now,
so UPS man runs to the ATF.
Yes. And they also were purchasing full M16 parts kits, which do have, you know, full auto sears and everything like that. But it's not a crime. It's very important. You could be like, oh, they could make it. Sure. But they didn't. They weren't making it. And it's not a crime to do that. But the ATF historically, even to today, likes to say, well, we
clarify though, it's not a crime to purchase these items.
Correct.
It is a crime to make those items.
Put them together.
Yes.
You can sell them all you want as kits at a gun show.
With an FFL license.
Anyone can buy it. Yes. Yeah, you can sell it. It's you commit a crime when you manufacture this drill holes out, when you manufacture these items together. The ATF loves to abuse their power, and they do this today. I'm not trying to get off on a tangent here. I'm just telling you that they constantly look at this, and they love to say, well, we think you're going to do that, so we're going to be the thought police here and just arrest you anyways. You know, so that's essentially what sparked this. Now, it should also be noted that, do you remember what I don't know if they said it in here, the local gun shop that the ATF visited? So the gun shop that the Davidians FFL did most of their business with, the ATF's first kind of stop was that gun shop, and they were asking questions about David Koresh, about the Davidians, and they were trying to essentially gain data for a warrant, a search warrant, right? Now, the other thing...
Well, and they also began with surveillance from a house across the road from the location.
Correct.
And several months before the siege.
And it was not a great cover-up because they were supposed to be four college guys that were middle-aged, that had brand new SUVs, and that lived at odd hours of the day and were outside with camera equipment.
Don't be suspicious.
Yeah, don't be suspicious. Now, at the at the FFL, the other interesting thing is that they actually had the owner of the FFL, the other, you know, the gun shop that they're trying to get information about the Davidians, call David Koresh and try to, like, ask him some probing questions. And David Koresh answered on the phone, and Steve Schneider were talking, and said, please come to Mount Carmel, and you can look at all of our books, you can look at the firearms that we have on hand, and we're not doing anything wrong. Please, you know, just come and investigate. We have no issue with you coming in. And David Koresh actually said to the gun shop owner on the phone, let me talk to the ATF head, and I'll explain the situation. And the ATF guy that was there said, no, we don't want to talk to you.
Interesting. So, I mean, they must have obtained something because they got a search warrant.
No.
On the suspicion that the Davidians were modifying the guns to have a leave.
All on suspicion.
Yeah, but I'm saying, so they get the search warrant, right?
Yeah.
So let's move along in the timeline here.
Right.
They get this search warrant, and then all of a sudden, they are talking about the search warrant commanding a search on or before the February 28th, 1993. And then they're making claims about this possible methamphetamine lab.
Yeah. So essentially, the ATF is like, we need to get the military involved. And the only time and the only possible way to get them involved is
drugs.
Drug claim. Right. Drugs. So they totally fabricate. There is not a shred of evidence saying that the Davidians are running a fucking meth lab out of it. But they claim
Except
that there's
the
a meth
looked.
Lab. Yeah. They claim that there's a meth lab. And therefore, they go to the local Texas Air National Guard or whatever.
Requested assistance from the DEA and the DOD.
Yeah.
Based on
the meth lab, because a plane with FLIR imaging from the National Guard flew over. And they're like, well, there's a hot spot in there.
Well,
and
let me give you
we think it's a meth lab.
So this is the list from the Wiki article. So they requested this assistance based on a recent delivery to the compound of chemicals, instruments, and glassware. That's a quote.
Okay.
Number two, a written testimony from a former compound resident alleging Koresh had told him that drug trafficking was a desirable way to raise money. That was probably Mark.
Right.
Three, several current residents who had prior drug involvement. Four, two former residents who were incarcerated for drug trafficking crimes. And five, as you mentioned, National Guard overflights, thermal imaging showing a hotspot inside the compound.
This is where I get frustrated with the Wiki article, because they are pulling shit out of their ass. And this was look, the ATF or the Wiki article is pulling from the original news stories.
Yeah.
But you can see here that I'm not trying to be biased. The ATF is pulling shit out of their ass and fabricating a drug charge to try to pull in additional help. Okay. They're totally fabricating it.
Well, the thing is they, high level, they want to get in there. They can't get in there because they don't have enough evidence. And so they need
evidence.
Right. They need to start fabricating
all
of these things to then request different levels of government to then come in. So there's all these like red tape that you have to get through.
On top of that, they actually originally started trying to request a Delta, like a high up Delta team, way up special forces team to infiltrate the buildings and all this other shit that they ended up getting denied because there wasn't as much credible evidence and all of this other shit. But you know,
so now they have the ATF. So now they have the DEA, the ATF, and the DOD and Texas state sheriffs, whatever.
Yeah, right now. Sorry, go ahead.
They're all sitting out here and they're planning this raid. They've now moved the date to March 1st, 1993.
Yeah. Now, they did end up getting from the military helicopters and vehicles, and then also some training support on how to use everything. Now, the other funny thing about the meth charges is that they're not going off of evidence of like a high input of meth dealings in Waco, or like there's meth coming in somewhere, or they see I would love to see essentially what those chemicals and glassware
like
were. Did
they
order a fucking cup set and then they got like bleach and they're like, well, you know, we think those are chemicals to make meth, so
like
fuck
a vase
you
for flowers.
Right. Mind you, this is the same ATF that helped actually funnel crack and cocaine up through Mexico. You had the house across the street, one of them sent an undercover ATF agent by the last name of Rodriguez into Mount Carmel.
HBO.
Yes, and the HBO series actually did showcase that properly. Now, Rodriguez, by the end of it, almost got turned into a Davidian. He almost stayed there. And in fact,
again,
he said,
power of persuasion.
In fact, at the end of it, he said, if they didn't come then, I may have ended up staying there.
Ooh, doggy.
So we have, because Koresh knew he was with the ATF.
Now, in this HBO series, if you watch it, you'll see a theme in the two outsiders that they then convince to become Davidians, one being David Thibodeau, the second being Rodriguez. They're kind of portrayed, and I don't know how accurate this is, as like down on their luck, you know, going through it. Rodriguez, I think, was having family issues, his children's issues or something like that. David Thibodeau was kind of lost soul, was in LA, didn't really know what he wanted to do with his life, like was a young guy.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't know how true that was, but the two people that they ended up convincing or possibly almost convinced were quite I would say easier to persuade.
Thibodeau, but not like as much.
Well, what I'm saying is those guys were, it was an easy portrayal of convincible people. There are others in this group that were highly educated, highly successful, did not need a group to identify with,
right,
but somehow were drawn in. So I just wanted to put that out here. But right, let's talk about this February 28th, basically attempt at executing this search warrant by the ATF.
So essentially here, you have to preface this with the ATF is not looking good, okay? They just came from Ruby Ridge, which, as we've talked about in the first Hidden History episode, didn't go so well for the ATF and didn't look good and ended in murder with the FBI. And yeah, not too great. So this agency is kind of on its last leg here. So they decide to get the press, the local press, in on this, and they want to just knock it out of the fucking park with a huge, I think it was like an 80-man team or something along those lines of ATF agents coming in on their white horses.
Dude, straight up.
Cavalry calling through fucking cattle cars.
They obviously were prepared for some sort of bloody battle because they had, it said in this article that the ATF agents had their blood type written on their arms or neck after leaving the staging area and before the raid,
right,
because it was recommended by the military to facilitate speedy blood transfusions in case of injury.
And this was with the local news reporters
who
had
just... When you're writing your blood type on your arm, you're not intending to do a peaceful...
Correct. And mind you, the warrant they got approved was for a knock warrant, which means like
knock on the door,
hey,
and if they don't
just
open
a heads
it,
up,
yeah,
like we're coming in, but you gotta, you know, come out and deal with this or whatever, right? So they come in this deep in cattle cars, full cert team, like they have, you know, their armor carbines ready to fucking go, and they have the local news with them with their cameras going, and they're like, we're gonna showtime, baby, like this is gonna be our fucking showtime. So they go, and this is where no one knows what happens to this day. So the Davidians get tipped off, right? The reason they got tipped off is actually from a local journalist who's lost and finds a postal worker in the middle of fucking nowhere. And that is accurate. They find a postal worker in the middle of fucking nowhere, and the news reporter's like, hey, I'm looking for this place called Waco. There's ATF going there, and I'm kind of lost. Can you help me? Sure enough, that postal worker was actually David Koresh's brother-in-law, currently on the way to Mount Carmel.
This is all, like,
coming back. Right. And then he goes in and is like, dude, they're coming. Like, Babylon is coming. And they assume that the federal government
is
Babylon.
This is what
they've
been preparing
for. Correct. The federal government at this point in time is actually cementing their belief system.
Did his brother see all of the military, like,
no,
or all of
yet
the ATF and everybody, like,
not
okay
yet.
But
don't
he,
believe
he just knew that something was going
yes
down.
And at that point, Rodriguez is actually in the building when the person
that's
said
right,
it.
That's right.
And Koresh and the Davidians look at him, and this is all verifiable, and Rodriguez said it. And at this point, they knew what was going on, and he said, I can't remember Rodriguez's first name, so I apologize. But Koresh pleads with him to call it off. He's like, I will talk to them. Please don't do this. There are women and children in here. We're not doing anything wrong. I'm trusting in you to help us. Rodriguez runs out of the building. At this point, he's amazed that his cover is blown and two, that he's not dead. And this also should showcase that the Davidians were obviously not offensive. Because at that point,
they
totally could have smoked fucking Rodriguez and threw him out the door.
You want to know something? Wikipedia doesn't mention Rodriguez one time.
Correct. And that is also because the ATF burned Rodriguez after this.
Right.
They said that he fell in with the Davidians and he was biased at that
point.
Well,
because didn't he come... What did he say when he came
Rodriguez
back?
Rodriguez came out and calls the head of the ATF that was heading this raid and says, they know, do not come. They are prepared. They're preparing right now. Not in the way of offense, but they're getting guns in the way of, like, we don't know what the fuck's gonna happen.
They're scared.
They're coming in hot, and we're like, we didn't do anything
it's
wrong.
Like, you just backed them into a corner and they're
correct
ready to fight for their life,
right? And they're ready to die for their beliefs. That's just,
which
is
the scariest thing. I mean,
right, these people believe the end of the world is coming and you are bringing the end of the world to them, and they are ready to die. So when it comes to Rodriguez, the ATF head, even though he now knows that they are that they know that they're prepared, and he was told by other heads of the government not to do this raid if they knew if
by
the cover
on
was
the
blown
inside.
If the cover was blown and they say, fuck it, we're going anyways, the cavalry's coming in and we're going to a fucking gunfight. That's what the ATF's mindset is with this. So the ATF rolls up. Now the controversies come out at who fired first, okay? So to the best of my knowledge and knowing how much information the ATF totally fucked with in this situation, here's my opinion on it. And Mary, you can talk about what's on the wiki page. The ATF, according to their own documents, had a dog dispatch team, right? And this is where everyone gets the jokes like the ATF's going to come and shoot your dog. It's because of this. So the Davidians had bred, I think it was another way to make money, but they were breeding dogs, and it was chows. So they had kennels, I think it was chows or something else, out of fear that the dogs were going to attack them from in the kennels, they shot all of the dogs. And that is verifiable, because throughout the siege, you could see bodies of all the dogs thrown all over the yard. In the fenced-in kennel. So they went over the kennel, murked all the fucking dogs. Now, my opinion is that once the gunshots rang out from the dogs being shot, the Davidians started to fire back.
Sure.
It, because they're like, what the fuck? And they assume they're being shot at by the ATF for
well,
because
no how
reason.
Are they supposed to know?
Correct. Now, according to the ATF, on their side, they roll up and the Davidians just start shooting out of the windows at them. For no reason at all. That they,
all right,
they
you
were
want me to give you what the wiki page says?
And they were supposed to deliver the warrant, and they're like, whoa, what the hell, guys? You're just shooting at us.
Yeah. So the wiki page doesn't say any of that. It says that the ATF agents stated that they heard shots coming from within the compound, while Branch Davidian survivors claim that the first shots came from the ATF agents outside. That's
correct.
All it says.
Right. And that's why I got
pissed.
It doesn't
say anything about Rodriguez. It doesn't say anything about the chows.
Yeah. And that's all accurate. I don't know that the breed of dogs is accurate. That's about all I can't remember. But when it
that
comes down
matter.
To it, David Thibodeau writes in his book, who was in the front room where the bullets started to fly, who was there, okay, from this firsthand account, this is what he says. He says they were there. He saw other Davidians getting rifles and getting armed because they didn't know what was going to happen. They knew they were on the way. He saw the situation with Rodriguez transpire. He sees Koresh talking to, I think his name is Perry Jones, who was like kind of his right-hand man and also his father-in-law at the time, look, I'm going to go talk to him. Koresh is saying, I'm going to go talk to him. Like, don't worry. Everyone's going to be okay. I'll go talk to him, and it's okay. It's okay. And so he goes outside.
Koresh
goes outside when they start rolling up in cattle cars, jumping out of the fucking cattle cars. And none of the Davidians know who fired first. That all of a sudden, David Thibodeau goes, all of a sudden, Koresh runs outside, starts talking, shots ring out, and a gunfight ensues.
And now Koresh is injured.
Koresh is shot twice. Perry Jones is fatally shot through the door.
That's right.
And he was unarmed.
That's right.
So here's where the issues start happening. All of the evidence that would showcase how many rounds the ATF fired blindly through the front door of the building is in, I believe, the left-hand side of the ginormous steel door.
Because there's a left door and a right door.
Correct. And that door, whether it's the left or right, I don't know, was lost.
In
the ginormous steel door
right.
was lost.
Arguably the main piece of evidence to really tack down who started this firefight.
Correct. And
on
top of that, you could see through multiple photos of the building during the siege, you could see the door, you could see how many rounds were coming through. Attorneys of the Davidians that came in throughout the siege talked about the door, wrote down the door, and Steve Schneider, all along the 51-day siege on the phone call with the FBI, was talking about how, just wait, because the door is going to show all of this, and we are going to bring the door to court, and everyone's going to see that you guys still are shoot so that that you guys were shooting blindly hundreds of rounds through the door. The
knowing full well that there's people inside there.
Correct. Now the and this is why this is one of the many pieces of evidence that is manipulated that is stolen from evidence. They manipulated the fucking evidence. The federal government took that evidence, which is why when you're trying to decipher who fired first, it's not too hard for me to believe that the ATF was coming in hot, decided to kill the fucking dogs because they thought the Davidians were gonna like unleash the dogs on them, and then they started shooting into the fucking compound because the Davidians
military,
were shooting back.
Trained ATF, you're scared of dogs.
Well, and look, look, dogs can mess you up. I
of
get it.
Of course they can,
in,
but they're
in
not
a
even
fucking kennel.
They're a kennel in a crate.
What
like,
are you doing?
And like the thing about it is, the ATF should know better than anybody that the minute a first shot rings out, that's when it,
and
then
it's
shit goes
a
down.
Knock fucking raid. And you're coming in that hot, ready to start shooting on a knock raid
with your
and
blood type written on your arm.
And you know they know you're coming. You know they're tipped off. You know they own an FFL. You know they have firearms in there that are legally fucking owned, and they're probably ready to defend themselves.
So at this point, who ATF retreats?
No. So the ATF gets in almost an hour-long firefight with the Davidians.
But Davidians are shooting back
as well.
The
Davidians are shooting back. Absolutely.
Sure.
So this is now a point of is this self-defense or not? Is this a justified shoot?
Is anyone else injured, wounded?
Yeah, so four ATF agents get fucking smoked. They're dead. Oh, yeah. Yeah, shot and killed. They start jumping in through the fucking windows, start going in because they assume the upper.
And that's the first one, the first raid this
yes,
happens.
Yes, the very first time. Shots ring out. Everyone starts shooting. Koresh comes inside. Mm-hmm. Perry Jones is shot to the point of fatally wounded. He dies later in the day. Okay. No one knows what the fuck is going on. And all the Davidians are inside. Women, children, they're like,
I was just
going
to say,
like,
now
what
this isn't
is
just
going
like
on?
A house full of men. There's
no.
Like babies, newborn
absolutely.
Babies.
Absolutely. So the women and children now go up to their quarters and they're all like huddling together as bullets are zipping through the fucking walls because the ATF is just railing rounds through the entire place, knowing full well that there are over 100 people in there, a lot of them unarmed women and children. Okay, so then the ATF is like, fuck, the weapons room is upstairs. We need to get to upstairs, David Koresh's room, and we need to secure the machine guns. So they get ladders and start going up to the second story, and this is where all the news footage,
yeah,
the famous news
that.
Footage of the ATF jetting into the fucking window. They get inside. One of the Davidians nails one of the ATF agents in the face right through the fucking window. The other guy, that's when he gets fatally shot and then like lays on the roof.
A Davidian.
No.
Oh.
The ATF agent, when he falls out the window, lays on the roof. He gets nailed. He's done.
So now we got two more that are
right.
killed.
So a total of four ATF agents fatally shot and I think 14 wounded out of the group. And at this point, there are helicopters flying above from the National Guard. And this is a huge, huge point of conflict as well. Because the helicopters claim.
Let me ask. Is this the one where, like, the point of contention where people are like, the helicopters were shooting, but
correct.
They're claiming that the helicopters were just observing?
The ATF is claiming we only had the helicopters there as a distraction. That's the ATF's official claim. We got the helicopters. They had no guns on board other than 9mm handguns.
Is there video footage of the?
There's video footage of helicopters.
Can you see the?
No. Now, the lawyers came into the buildings and saw David Koresh's room, and their quote on record under oath in court was that the ceiling looked like Swiss cheese and that there were hundreds of bullet holes through
the
ceiling
top.
Of Koresh's room coming in. And the thought was that the helicopters were specifically there to target Koresh's room, hoping he would be there, and railed down gunfire from above.
Well, kill the leader, right?
Yes.
Like, chop off
and multiple Davidians claim that they knew and saw gunfire coming from the helicopters, which should not have happened.
That's, okay, so no one comes in, right? ATF doesn't make it into the building.
No, and
they try, they don't succeed.
The only time that they stop the firefight is because they almost ran out of ammo. They were completely spent and they had no ammo left. And the Davidians are on the phone with the local sheriff's department, right now saying, what is going on? Why are you shooting? And the Wayne, who is the attorney or whatever, is like, this is not us. We aren't firing anymore. You're still shooting in. There's women and children in here. We are unarmed. People are dying. Please stop shooting. And finally, the sheriff secures a ceasefire with the ATF. The ATF didn't even tell the local sheriff's department because they thought he was like in on it with the Davidians that they were performing the raid. And now finally we agree to a ceasefire. And here's another very important point. The Davidians let the ATF pick up their dead and wounded and retreat peacefully. Mind you, the same ATF that is currently out there, barely undercover, and now has almost no ammunition left. And the Davidians have a good bit of ammo. They're not out yet. So you're telling me you think these people are sick psychopaths that are just bloodthirsty on federal agents. They could have smoked every last one of those ATF agents while they were retreating under a field with no trees, no cover,
no rocks, nothing. Yeah, that's a very important point.
If
you see any, and we'll try to link the actual news footage, you'll see that this location was completely desert almost,
yeah,
really.
They could have killed every one of those guys. Every one of them, but they didn't. And they allowed them to retreat. It was all, and this is where the psychiatrist came in and said multiple times, this is a defensive
religious posture,
not an offensive. If it was offensive, you all would be dead. That's it.
That's an interesting point. So, okay, right. They retreat, Davidians retreat. Now they're looking after their wounded. ATF is looking after theirs. Now ATF is like even more so, we have every right to go in and F their day
up. Now they're pissing contest. Now they got smacked in the dick a little bit. And now they're like, okay, this isn't good. And now we look real bad.
Right.
And now there's women and children in there. And now our raid didn't go as planned. And now we got multiple dead agents and we've been shot at. And on top of that, there's actual news footage of them beating the shit out of the journalists that they told to be there and them stealing the camera and destroying the tapes as they pulled back.
So does the FBI come in to clean up essentially?
Correct. Okay. The FBI is now like, here's the second time that we come in and fix your fuck up. You guys are done. You are out of here. You are out of here completely. So they are there, and the FBI is no better, right?
Right.
Because they're led by the HRT, the Hostage Rescue Team, or Hostage Response Team or whatever, which is the FBI's essentially tactical wing to deal with threats, right? And the head person at the FBI HRT team is well-known in Ruby Ridge.
Richard Rogers.
Yes, and is also well-known in Waco for being incredibly offensive, wanting to go hands-on, wanting to go tactical, and using very, very aggressive measures because his thought process is we're going to force them out.
So now we start with a connection of FBI getting in contact with Koresh.
Right.
So now you have hostage negotiators in contact with Koresh.
Surprisingly, over 100, I believe,
yes,
FBI negotiators over the 51-day siege.
So in the first few days, the FBI believed that they had made a breakthrough when they negotiated with Koresh, this agreement that the branch of Davidians would peacefully leave the location in return for a message recorded by Koresh that would be broadcast on national radio.
About the Seven Seals.
Right. So So Koresh agreed to this, correct?
Yes.
He recorded it.
Yes.
He sent it out. They did broadcast it.
Yep.
And they were very disappointed, FBI was, because Koresh said in his audio recording, which I...
No, he said afterwards on the phone. So they sent it
out. Oh, yes. Okay.
They sent it out.
Right.
He was not pleased with it or something like that. And then he said, I just got a prophecy from God and he told me we are waiting inside. So he's then saying we're not coming
right
out.
So now they're like, shit, we thought we had him. We thought he would come out peacefully.
And they did send out 19 women and children.
With
that time. Or maybe it was just 19 children.
I don't know. The wiki page just says shortly after they negotiated the release of 19 children without their parents. And that 98 people remained in the building.
Right.
Allegedly, the children had been this is what the wiki page is saying. Allegedly, the children had been physically and sexually abused long before the standoff. This was the key justification ordered by the FBI.
Totally fabricated. Totally from Thibodeau from multiple people, and later, the FBI recanted those claims.
Okay.
And said, we had claims of child abuse. Those were unsubstantiated. We had claims of child sexual abuse, unsubstantiated. And they actually lied. I'm not a fan of Janet Reno, okay, who is the attorney general
Who's
or whatever.
Janet Reno?
She was the person who okayed the use of tear gas at the very end.
Okay.
She was the person that gave their approval. They lied to her on fucking record. They lied to her on record and said, you need to do this now. We need to go in there and force because babies are being beaten. They're being raped. They're killing kids in there. And we need to go in there to stop this. And you need to approve this because that's the only way this is getting done.
So
they said afterwards, after this all took place, they did this. They're like, oh, fuck. They told Janet Reno after, or Janet Reno came forward and is like, this is what they told me. And the FBI's like, well, we were wrong. We didn't mean that. And, you know, it doesn't matter now, but
like,
we were wrong.
Janet Reno, we didn't know you were going to go tell everyone that we told you that.
Exactly. So that's
let's
fabricated
not get ahead,
bullshit.
Let's not get ahead of ourselves.
Correct.
Here. So
but
on,
that is what they said.
Right. On day 9, so this is Monday, March 8th of 1993, the Branch of Davidians sent out a videotape to show the FBI that there were no hostages, but everyone was staying inside on their own free will. So basically making a video of people explaining like,
yeah.
I am here because I am choosing to be here.
Yeah.
You know, there's
as a
nothing,
way of protest, essentially.
Right. Or to calm them down. I'm sure they were freaking petrified and they wanted
point,
to...
I'm sorry. I'm running over you. I'm so sorry.
No, but I feel like at this point, I mean, the people that are in the building are probably doing everything they can to be able to like peacefully end this.
Well, and on top of that, okay, at this point, everyone inside assumes that if they leave the building, similar to Ruby Ridge, they will be shot.
Yeah.
They will just be shot on sight. And that is also because a guy by the name of Mike, who was a Davidian, was trying to make his way back to the Mount Carmel and was outside of Mount Carmel when the raid took place and is sneaking back into the buildings. And the ATF shot him, killed him outside, and they claim that he had weapons and was shooting back at them. There's the Davidians say that there's no substantial evidence to that, and he was just shot walking to the buildings. Now,
so wait, after that video comes out,
they didn't release it.
Well, right. So they didn't release it, but they did watch it. And then, and I remember this in the HBO miniseries, there kind of became two groups of people in the FBI. One,
the negotiators.
Group, well, right. The negotiators who really, and they show this in the series, that really wanted to try to peacefully end this. They didn't want to see any more death. They wanted to really and really truly believe that they could figure this out based on negotiation alone.
Yeah.
Negotiation tactics. And then you had the other half or the other group that were like, no, forcibly need to remove these people. We need to mess with their minds. This is when you start, they start with the sleep deprivation of the inhabitants throughout.
Psychological warfare with
all night broadcasts of recordings of jet planes, pop music, chanting, and the screams of rabbits being slaughtered
all night, and then lights on the building. They also cut their heat, they cut their water,
they cut the power and the water.
Very important point, because the Davidians at this point, it was incredibly cold these Texas nights, getting into 20 degrees, and they had to use nothing but propane heaters and propane kerosene lighters in order to keep the building
a little
warm.
Foreshadowing.
Okay.
So,
Now, but there's another point, though, that real quick that you skipped over, that they didn't release the footage of the video because they thought too many people would get a conscience for Koresh and the Davidians.
Right.
Like, they would feel sympathy,
like
so
Ted,
they just...
Like a Ted Bundy weird thing, like, where people started to, like him or whatever.
Right.
So, 11 people at this point, after the psychological warfare began, there was another group of 11 people that left the location of the Davidians and... were arrested as material witnesses.
And the Davidians are also seeing these people leave and get immediately shackled and thrown on the ground. And so they're like, look, I don't want to go to jail either. I don't think we did anything wrong. So it encourages them to stay inside. Also, all of these people had the ability to leave on their free will at any point in time. David Koresh was not holding them, you know, by gunpoint at a hostage situation, although the FBI was treating it like that.
Well, but, you know, the thing is, David Koresh may not have been holding them at gunpoint, but the ATF in a way and the FBI were in a way.
Correct. Yeah.
Almost doing the opposite of what they quote unquote intended to
now,
do.
Now, the other thing that the miniseries does not accurately depict, because they don't want to showcase the government in such a negative light, the FBI negotiators were not these sweet, awesome people like that one guy was portrayed as. In fact, none of them were like that. When
I think it's more of an egotistical trip of like, no, we're going to handle this the way that my experts say they're going to handle
now,
it.
Now, the multiple times when Koresh would start on his dialogues about the Seventh Seal and why they were there and what they were doing, they would tell him verbatim, stop with the Bible babble. We don't care. And they were told by this self-claimed cult expert that they requested told them verbatim that the negotiator should insult Koresh, make him feel and make his followers feel that he's a bad person and let them go. Meanwhile, these other psychiatrists and other people, theologists that study Revelations in the Bible said, No, you need to show them and you need to respect their opinions, but show them a different way that this can end. Show them that Revelations may be interpreted differently, right?
Or that this isn't the end of the world.
Yes, and to fast forward with this, because we're already getting kind of tight on time, you actually have them do this. They compile together a video or a videotape or whatever showing David, look, we get this. We're theologists ourselves. We understand where you're coming from. I validate what you're saying. This is the interpretation. God doesn't have to make you die here. There's other peaceful alternatives. You guys can survive. You can get your message out.
And they show it in the miniseries, but I believe that the journalists, the news reporters actually started to show, like I know in specific in the miniseries, David Thibodeau's mother came on national news, and I guess, I don't know, somehow, maybe it was before they cut the power.
That was happening early in the siege, not after.
Well, but just another tactic to get them to come out. So they have family members now pleading with the people that are inside, come out.
Now,
so I want to move along.
Yeah, so...
So newly appointed U.S. Attorney General Janet Reno approved recommendations by the FBI hostage team to mount an assault after being told that conditions were deteriorating and that children were being abused inside the compound, as we mentioned. So this standoff, mind you, was costing millions of dollars
per day. $1 million per day.
So they're now 51 some day, like they're now mounting this assault. You're like, wait, months into this.
Yeah.
So yes, of course the conditions are deteriorating. These people are running out of resources. They're running out of food, water. Their power is cut. They're being manipulated. They're psychological warfare. So it's not looking
now,
great.
Now 3 days before the fire, okay? 3 days before the fire, that video is sent in and David Koresh agrees. They say, cool, we're going to peacefully come out. And David Koresh says, we will come out once I've finished writing the seven seals, his understanding of the seven seals to
basically
spread to the world.
Basically his prophecy.
Right, which he did. And he was currently in the middle of it. The peaceful negotiations were going well. David Thibodeau on the inside was talking about people packing their bags. Everyone was happy. And the FBI said, fuck this. We're not waiting anymore. We now are authorizing the use of CS gas, and we're going in by force. After they told the Davidians, we'll peacefully let you out. And then all of a sudden, Janet Reno, because the FBI says, hey, look, we told them about peacefully letting them out. They're abusing kids, and we need to go in hard. So Janet Reno says, that's cool. Don't use pyrotechnic explosives.
So we start with the first raid in March 1st. We're now April 19th, and this is when this second assault, the more well-known, publicly well-known assault takes place.
Where actual tanks distributing CS gas start plowing into the fucking building.
So they say, FBI and all of that, they say, fuck it. They're using explosives, and they come in. And they're using explosives at this point to, what, punch holes into the building, essentially,
to
then be able to get the CS gas, the tear gas, if you will, to you know, come through the building and make its way through. Because it's a big building.
It's ginormous.
I mean, this is huge, yeah, right? So the CES gas is very tough unless you're inside different parts of the building to then get it, like, really ruminating, if you will. Yeah. Right. So then they were told that officially no armed assault was to be made. They were strictly supposed to use just the tear gas, correct?
Correct. And only fire if they were fired upon. So only shoot at them if the Davidians were shooting back.
So at this point, there's holes in the building. They're pushing this gas, pumping this gas through the building as much as they can. And after more than 6 hours, none of the Davidians had left the building. They were sheltering instead in an underground concrete block room
specifically
called the bunker.
The women and children.
Right, within the building. Or they were in other parts of the building using gas masks to retreat or do whatever they need to do. Get materials into the bunker because they thought that's where they'd be. At around noon, 3 fires broke out.
Yeah.
And this is where you see this controversy start to really pile up. So these 3 fires broke out almost simultaneously in different parts of the building. The government maintains that the fire was deliberately started by the Branch of Davidians. Joe, I know you have some thoughts on this. Hit me with it.
So that's the official story. Okay. Right. According to
if you're watching the news in 1993 on April 19th,
you're getting, look, we distributed some
tear gas. These crazy psychos have set their building on fire. They want to die.
Mass suicide. Yeah. And we don't know what happened. And they're all in there and they're not coming out. Right. On the inside, according to Thibodeau and multiple other Davidians that were on the inside of the building, they recall hearing, first of all, they all thought they were going to be allowed to come out peacefully. And all of a sudden, tanks start moving forward onto the property and start screaming through their loudspeakers, this is not an attack. Please don't fire upon us. David Thibodeau states multiple times the irony, the horrendous irony of this, when he heard from the loudspeakers, this is not an attack. This is not an attack. As they plowed through a wall where one of the Davidians was standing and he got ran over by a tank tread that was saying, this is not an attack, as it sheared his leg from the top of his hip down and actually caused the tank tread to run into a malfunction because it was taken up by his leg, okay, as it's running over people into the buildings. Multiple times, the people on the FBI side say, wait a second, we don't know where anyone is, where we're plowing through the walls of this building. There are multiple children and women who end up dying due to cement debris falling and crushing their head when the tank plows through the fucking walls. Okay.
And not to mention this whole time, there's also tear gas being
pumped
through.
There's CS gas everywhere. And now the tanks, which is also not mentioned in the media, are blocking exits. They are plowing down doorways and exits out of the building.
But come out. Come out. What are you doing?
This is not an attack. This is not an attack as we're shearing your friend's leg off with the treads of our tank. Don't fire upon us. This is not an attack. If you didn't already know, CS gas, multiple types of CS gas, is actually banned under the Geneva Convention to use indoors in warfare. But it was okayed by Janet Reno in this civilian encounter.
Is it flammable?
Yes, it is incredibly flammable.
So you could say it's a pyrotechnic.
Well, no, it's not a pyrotechnic. However, the other thing and why it's banned in warfare to use indoors is if it catches fire indoors, it creates cyanide gas. So it creates an incredibly toxic and lethal gas from cyanide poisoning. I think it's cyanide, but cyanide. Yeah, so the house is, at this point, they've been warming themselves with kerosene heaters throughout this entire 51-day
siege. Propane tanks
everywhere. There are propane tanks and heaters all over the building,
CS
everywhere.
CS gas everywhere.
Now there has been a 4-hour-long CS gas is a powder. It's actually a powder.
Right.
So there is CS powder.
All over the floor.
Flammable powder. Walls everything. Now, they were told because of this.
So let me just say, perspective-wise, it would literally take the tiniest little spark.
Correct.
It would, like, even if it was a tank rubbing up, getting caught on its own treads and rubbing up against and creating, like, a little spark. Like, I'm just trying to, like, picture how little it would take for a fire to start.
Now, There is also claims from the Davidians that where the women and children were hiding in the bunker because tanks were destroying everything, that a tank actually plowed through the wall of the bunker with its hose and actually filled the bunker to the top with CS gas while the women and children were
blocking
unarmed
the exit.
In there, blocking the exit. So essentially suffocating them to death with CS gas in a fucking makeshift gas chamber at this point. The Davidians are there, and all of a sudden the fires start. Now, David Thibodeau claims in his book that, look, we don't know how the fire started. The main thing that the Davidians think is that the fires were actually inadvertently started by the feds.
Yeah.
So the Davidians aren't saying, look, they lit us all on fire.
Purpose.
They're saying that they probably didn't know that this was going to happen, but it happened. It also was proven in court that they did end up using multiple pyrotechnic grenades, including flashbangs, in the last day of the siege.
Well, there you go.
Correct. And that the FBI said, first, they lied under oath and said, we did not use pyrotechnics. Then, 5 years later, they said, well,
we did
use pyrotechnics, but we only threw them in a watered-down pit outside of the building. My ass, you lied the first time. Why would we believe you the second time?
And why would you put something in a wet pit?
Exactly.
What would be the point of
that? And the Davidians said that they actually saw a pile of flashbangs and pyrotechnics and other shit spent after the fire, and the feds found it, and the federal agents said that actually those were illegal suppressors, and we're going to arrest all the Davidians on illegal suppressors. So more than likely what happened, okay, and I know there's audio tapes out there that people are going to quote allegedly about the Davidians saying that we need to start this fire. Those audio tapes can be barely understood. They can be absolutely taken out of context. And this is from the same agency that has lied each and every step of the way about every form of evidence that they have brought to the table. I don't fucking believe it. I don't believe that is the proper evidence that is coming forward. I don't believe it for a fucking second. That could be taken out of context in any way, shape, or form.
So, and as you can imagine, only 9 people left the building during the fire. David Thibodeau included in that. The remaining branch Davidians, including the children, were either buried alive by rubble, suffocated, or shot. According to the FBI, Steve Schneider, Koresh's top aide, shot and killed Koresh and then killed himself.
Yeah.
So in total, 76 people died.
Fucking murdered.
The autopsy photographs of other children locked in what appeared to be spasmatic death poses are consistent with cyanide poisoning, one of the results produced by burning the CS gas.
Yeah.
Also, autopsy records also indicate that at least 20 branch Davidians were shot, including Koresh, as well as 5 children under the age of 14. There was a 3-year-old, just warning you, this is graphic, the 3-year-old Dayland Gent, who was actually stabbed in the chest.
Yeah. So essentially, the Davidians at this point, coming from their point of view, are now locked in a box filled with CS gas that is now turning into cyanide gas. They are all dying, and they are being burned alive by an incredibly hot fire that is surrounding the building as the tanks have now destroyed most of their exits. So at this point,
was Thibodeau in the bunker?
No. He was trying to make his way to the bunker to the women in there and the children, and the fire got too great and he dived out the window.
Dove
out the window. Sorry. So at this point, we have mercy killings going on. So now they're locked in a box. They're watching their kids suffocate and die and be burned alive. And they're now shooting their kids out of mercy because the entire building is crumbling down on top of them. So that's the position that these people are in. And mind you, by spasmatic positions, that's a really nice way of saying that multiple toddler-age children were found with their fucking backs of their head touching their heels in a spasmed position where their backs broke behind them, shattered, because their body was spasming from fucking cyanide gas poisoning. Okay. So that's what the media doesn't want you to tell. And the only thing that you will see about the Waco fires in the mainstream media is that they started it. That these people started it. They were crazy, psycho, religious people. Don't worry about us. Don't worry about the evidence we covered up. Don't worry about us using pyrotechnic devices.
Don't worry about the lies that we told.
Don't worry about the lies we told. Don't worry about the fact that this was all substantiated off no evidence whatsoever about machine guns and drug charges that we completely fabricated and made up to make ourselves look better. Don't worry about the fact that we are covering up fucking evidence that we're going to release 5 years from now that you aren't going to know because you're not going to care about at that point. And don't worry about the fact that we just murdered 76 and mostly unarmed women and children, gassing them alive like in a fucking concentration camp in World War II, right here on U.S. soil, from the people that are still in power today, from the people that still do raids today, from the people that are still fucking taking firearms and doing raids to this fucking day. Not only that, the surviving Davidians, and we'll wrap it up with this, that exited the building, got thrown in handcuffs, and most of those Davidians, aside from, I believe, 5 of the remaining 12 that survived, got charged with 40 years each, mainly. You know what the federal agents got charged with? Not a goddamn thing. They got a little slap on the wrist. They said, this cost us a lot of money, and it doesn't look too good, so you guys are going to be moved to a different thing. But you know what? Mistakes are made, and we're the federal government, so we can do what the fuck we want to do.
And also, nothing remains of those buildings today, and actually...
There is a chapel, actually.
Well, yes, but I mean, other than the main building, other than the concrete foundation components, the entire site was actually bulldozed 2 weeks after the end of the siege. And as Joe mentioned, only a small chapel built years after the siege stands on the site. And as Joe mentioned, just to confirm that, the grand jury charged, among other things, the branch of Davidians had conspired to and aided abetted to murder of federal officers and had unlawfully possessed and used various firearms. They acquitted 4 of the branch of Davidians on all charges. And additionally, the jury acquitted all of the branch of Davidians on murder related charges, but did convict 5 of them on a lesser charge, including aiding and abetting the voluntary manslaughter of federal agents. 8 branch Davidians were then convicted on firearm charges as well, meaning they're grasping at straws just to find something to charge.
And there's no evidence of firearm charges. That's right. The best part of it. There is absolutely no physical evidence
of that.
There's no physical evidence.
Sat in jail.
They didn't find. They claim they found guns in a fire. No. They claim that they found guns in the fire. They didn't. They claim they found suppressors, which were probably their own flashbangs and other pyrotechnic fucking CS grenades that they were covering up. And they charged these people essentially the rest of their lives over no basis of any evidence whatsoever. Over the ATF saying, we think you are probably going to do this. That's all this. There are no charges of child abuse. There are no charges of David Koresh marrying people underage. All those fucked up things that actually did happen. This isn't even about that. They ended up getting charged because they fired in defense of themselves, and that they may or may not have. We kind of think they had intentions to build machine guns, guns that fire a little faster than other guns, in the middle of fucking nowhere in the desert of Texas.
As you can see. The religion, I mean, it's just so much. It's so heavy. It's very, very heavy. There is a lot of information that you just gave. All of it very accurate. Joe is a very well-researched person in this topic. Take it for what you will. I mean,
yeah,
We've presented our opinions on the different various aspects of this case, if you will, from the religious practices that we don't necessarily agree with, but do we agree with the murder and torture of 76 people or
no.
The whole no we do not.
And it doesn't matter, you know, whatever you think of Koresh, and absolutely I think he was kind of a fucked up guy a little bit. Absolutely. I think he was very mistaken on a lot of parts. They did not deserve this.
No.
Not even in the slightest.
And it's a scary thing to imagine that those are the people in power that
today
are the ones that respond to calls like this. And
right.
Yeah, it's just a really scary thought. And it's
yep.
a really complex thing. And especially when you add the fire to it, it makes the investigation so difficult because everything, like imagine if nothing was actually burned.
Yeah.
And they actually could pull evidence from the building.
And mind you, the only people that had access to the scene were the FBI and the ATF, okay, afterwards, and they bulldozed the entire fucking thing. And the Texas Rangers wanted to come in because they said, we need an unbiased law enforcement source to search for research. By the time they got in, the evidence was gone. Destroyed, everything gone, and the ATF just, and the FBI reported everything. Totally fucking fabricated half of the stuff. But I'll tell you guys what, I'll leave you with the quote that David Thibodeau wrote and signed in my book that I have, which is, again, one of my favorite books. I would highly recommend you read it. I would highly recommend you learn about this atrocity. And what I will leave you with is his quote, which is, "The truth shall set you free, and the free shall seek the truth." And I think that is a very important thing that we try to, even before, long before this episode, we try to get across in this podcast, which is seeking the truth. It's
look
a
beyond.
Heavy episode. Thank you guys so much for listening. As always, check out those links, do your own research, and as always, stay tuned for more great content coming soon.